Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 18th, 2000. In the fireside room this evening is Michael Shett. Today's session number is 2002, and it's titled Simpler Living, Compassionate Life, Caring for Creation from a Christian Perspective, Global Economics in a Sacred Universe, Including a Christian Perspective on Caring for the Earth. Let's listen in.
Nice to see you all. And who wasn't here yesterday? Just to get a sense of 2, 3, 4. Okay. Well, my name is Mike Scutt, and I work with Earth Ministry in Seattle. And we're both on the level of education and awareness building on the connections between faith, particularly Christian faith, in an ecumenical way. And caring for Earth, and then have some very practical programs that help people sort of express that in daily life, one of them being a community-supported agriculture farm that we get churches involved in and supporting, and others being starting or providing curricula to help build communities of support in churches to ask the question, you know, what does it mean to be Christian in this global consumer culture today? And that's one of the things that this book, Simpler Living, Compassionate Life, has to do a lot with. It's a collection of about 30 essays and then a 12-week study guide along with it. And much of what I'm talking about this week is out of this book. And if you're interested in getting a copy, you can do so here, and I'll pass the money on to the bookstore. And they also, I think, still have copies at the bookstore, just not out on the shelf right now. So, let's have a prayer before we begin, if you will. Creator, sustainer, redeemer, for another beautiful day and a beautiful place to be, we are very grateful. May your presence be with us now and always, and give us eyes to see. In your name, amen. So, yesterday, just for those who weren't here, briefly, we went over the title of the book is Simpler Living, Compassionate Life. So we kind of covered those two aspects of the title, and then had a discussion about what that brings up for people. And one of the things that, I mean, I've written up on the board what I was thinking of doing today. I mean, the title is Global Economics in a Sacred Universe, and to talk a bit about our dominant cultural religion, which John Cobb calls economism, and move into some, and how in a sense our economic system requires of us that we see the world in a profane way, as opposed to living in a deep sort of sense of the sacred, of that the universe is sacred. And I was thinking of some biblical resources for creation care or for supporting the view that all is sacred. And then moving into comparing and contrasting human economy and nature's economy, and how we might move toward move the human economy more toward reflecting nature's economy, and thus, in a sense, moving toward a more sustainable economics, which, in my way of looking at things, is also a more simple economics. Someone, Mike, came up to me this morning and said, "You know, I was having a hard time following some of what you're saying yesterday about simpler living, because what I actually think you were talking about was sustainability." And that, so it might be a confusion in terms. I think in some ways, in talking about simpler living in this broader context, I've wanted to expand how people think about simpler living, because I think it does get limited to sometimes toward personal growth, like we talked about yesterday, or toward relationship with time and money, and doesn't connect with people's passion for the earth and passion for social justice. And I think it does call us to that. But perhaps a better word for your understanding or from where you're coming from is moving towards sustainability and a spirituality of sustainability. So in case that helps you, I thought that was a helpful comment from Mike. Now, any comments so far? There was also some energy around sort of how to, you know, what, so what? How do we live more simply? Or, you know, what does this mean for practical choices? And that's partly why there's this handout. Most of you got it yesterday. It's called Brainstorming and Resources, Practical Ideas for Change. And we didn't go through it because you can go through it on your own. But it might be helpful at some point this week to have a discussion about what you find is working in your life and what, because there's a lot of wisdom amongst us here about practices that have moved you toward expressing your values in everyday life, towards simpler living, towards sustainability. But this sheet is meant to point you to resources, either curricula or videos or websites or practical actions you can take that would make a difference and would express much of what we were talking about yesterday. So that is there, and I encourage you to look at it. And there's even, investing came up yesterday as one of the questions, let's say, and there's a reference here to the Green Money Journal, for example, a phone number and a website to a group that will point you towards socially and environmentally responsible investing. And at least these companies have a social and environmental screen when they look at what they invest in, for example. So there are resources like that out there, and that's what this handout is for. So I guess, you know,
Well, in terms of sharing an experience, I consider this both voting with our wallet and then going to what's D here, community supported agriculture.
Yeah.
That's been a very good experience for our family.
Uh-huh.
For one thing, you're dealing directly with the growth of organic produce because the farm that we buy from does that. Secondly, you have a chance to participate and go out in the countryside once or twice a summer and get some dirt on your feet and you'd be reminded of what it was like to have a vegetable garden, which all of us who grew up at the time of World War II was a lot of our fathers had vegetable gardens. It was patriotic. I miss it. But that keeps it in a community sense, so there are good things about it. And then, in our case, you know, people grow a lot of interesting food, they grow different things, they try, I don't know, how many different kinds of tomatoes did they have last year? It was 30, 40, 50, 100 varieties, you know, they were sort of experimenting. So it improved the quality of life in several ways. The food was better for you, it was more interesting. The dollars were staying with that particular organization, which happens to be across the border in Wisconsin. I don't support Wisconsin people that often, but.
That's awfully big of you. Yeah.
And I suspect, you know, either through farmers market or something else, and practically everybody from anywhere could find that. You can't make it replace all of the groceries you ever buy, but
right.
You sure can have it supplement. And during the summer, it's our only source of vegetables. It's really good. So I'd just like to speak on behalf of it.
Community supported agriculture is one of the more encouraging movements and one of the more everyday practical ways you could move toward what we'll talk about later, modeling a circle in your economic choices as opposed to modeling the line of the global economy. And
it didn't increase our costs. We're spending the money on food anyway.
Yeah, you really don't tend to increase your costs, and you're supporting a local organic farmer. Usually you're supporting good, you know, soil and water conservation, good food for yourself, like you've said. Plus you're keeping a farmer in business on his or her land. Land that's often close to urban areas and therefore is, you know, potential to be developed, built on soon. So there's just lots of neat spin-offs about supporting a community-supported agriculture farm. You can talk with Tori more about that, or myself. Larry's a part of one. I'm not sure what your folks' names are, but you can grab them and ask them about their experience more. But I thought I would move into this stuff, unless, you know, you all want to spend some more on this. Is there a sense about that? people want to move on to what we're going to do today. Because the stories are very helpful, the how-to on simpler living, and maybe we'll have some time for that at the end as well. I want to just read something from a presentation I gave recently about sort of our cultural religion, and then we'll move into this biblical resources and then talking about the economic system that under which we live, really. A worldview is a way of seeing. As I talked about yesterday, a worldview foregrounds certain assumptions and backgrounds others. Charlene Spreknak says, our worldviews are often, they often go unexamined, like water is to a fish, so prevalent and all pervasive that we don't even realize it's there. But it sort of defines everything in our lives. One example would be the Western Christianity has emphasized God's transcendence. And Larry referred to this in the presentation just before this. If God is way out there and that's it, then the world, in a sense, becomes bereft of God's presence, and we move toward living in a profane universe. And it's also then easier to practice dominion in a damaging way. But the Christian tradition also radically affirms God's immanence in us, in creation. And so what is it, how is it that you grew up thinking in that, just that one element of your worldview or theology, God's transcendence, God's immanence, and are both there fully? And that would make a difference in sort of how we think and act on this place. So moving toward greater simplicity, and remember when I say that I'm talking about living out of core values, of living a life that reflects your heart, and is not only about addressing consumptive habits. This sort of movement in our lives is difficult, at least partly because it challenges our culture's dominant worldview, or our culture's implicit religion, I should say. John Cobb calls it economism, the god of economic growth, the primary religion of Western human beings. And David Corton, who wrote When Corporations Rule the World, describes these religiously held convictions in the following way. No single idea is more deeply embedded in modern political culture than the belief that economic growth is the key to meeting most important human needs, including alleviating poverty and protecting the environment. So he lays it out very succinctly there, that that's sort of the implicit religion, Cobb calls it economism, of our culture. And I believe that movement towards simplicity does need to challenge this human economic construct in its increasingly globalized state. And to do so, therefore, is to challenge our dominant culture of religion. By saying so, I'm suggesting we human beings have a tendency to make a god out of something. And Western culture has made a god of economic growth. It is our idol. And I've always found a helpful definition of idol to be, it promises something it cannot finally deliver. An idol promises something it cannot finally deliver. And author Roger Walsh, who's wrote an article on the psychology of sustainability, and I like this quote a lot. He says, the only trouble with substitute gratifications, which is essentially what idols become, the only trouble with substitute gratifications is that you can never get enough of what you do not really need. You can never get enough of what you do not really need. So it becomes rather vicious. And then just to talk about one shift that would need to occur in our culture to move us from this sort of implicit religion of economism would be to move toward living in a sacred universe, which I believe is what we do live in, whether we realize it or not. We must, and actually when I mean this book is about so many different topics like time, money, economics, justice, food choices, theology, worldview, moving toward deeper community, human and non-human and so on. And it's like at the end of it, how do you write an epilogue, right? So, about all these things. But the thing that came to mind, one of them, was that that would summarize it, would be we must move toward re-inhabiting a sacred universe. And in a way, the best way to talk about that are stories. And tomorrow on the hike, I think I'll read a story that happened to me, an experience with aspen trees that will sort of, it has embodied that for me of living in a sacred universe. Another way to say that is we must see the sacred in the ordinary. Philip Sherard, who is one of England's sacred, celebrated poets and theologians, says the following: "We are treating our planet in an inhuman and God-forsaken manner because we see things in an inhuman, God-forsaken way. And we see things in this way because that is basically how we see ourselves, in an inhuman, God-forsaken way." He is suggesting that we no longer see ourselves and the Earth as sacred. And I would suggest that this is in direct contrast with the Christian tradition, with all of us being made in God's image, with all of creation being called very good, and so on. And we'll get to that in a moment. And also, I would suggest that our economic system requires us, in a sense, to finally, if push comes to shove, to see all things, human and non-human, finally as resources, not as expressions of who God is, not as sacred beings created in God's image, and as a place imbued with God's presence, again, God's immanence. So if you can hold those, let's go to the Biblical Resources Creation Care for sort of this, a brief discussion of resources you might use. Also, I kind of offer this also as like a something you might use in your own congregation, because they're very simple principles, really. And when you're talking to people in your congregation, perhaps, about what is it we're called to as Christians, or why is it we're called to this as Christians. And then we'll move into this discussion of economics and the sacred profane distinction. Any questions or comments so far? Feel free to just interject. Okay. These first three are taken from Calvin DeWitt, a professor of biology at Madison, University of Wisconsin, and they're earthkeeping, fruitfulness, and Sabbath. And I'll write them down here. Earthkeeping. Genesis 2:15, fruitfulness, and Sabbath. Genesis 1, and this is Leviticus 23. So this is partly based on some questions yesterday too about, so where would you point, what would you point to in the scriptures that would, you know, help us in this regard? Because, you know, Larry's been spending time on this creation care from a Christian perspective, as I have, and these are just some biblical resources for you to think about. So there are two creation accounts, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. And apparently Genesis 2 was actually written before Genesis 1. But so we'll talk about Genesis 1 in a minute. But first I want to talk about Genesis 2:15, where God says, you know, the scriptures say, Adam and Eve are put in the garden to, it's usually translated, till and keep the garden. Probably very familiar with that verse. We're put in the garden to till and keep it. And apparently the word till is the word abad in Hebrew. And it's the same word that shows up in Numbers, as for me and my house, we will abad the Lord. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. So if you look in a literal translation of the scriptures, you will find the word serve there. God places Adam and Eve in the garden to serve the garden. And then the second word is keep, which according to Calvin DeWitt is an accurate translation, but there are different ways of keeping something. And he tells, you know, how you can keep something, you can keep a cucumber in all its relationships in the garden, you know, in relationship with sun, water, soil, and so on. Or you can take it out of the garden and pickle it and preserve it, a preservationist kind of keeping. And he says this kind of keeping, the connotation of this keeping in the word, the Hebrew word, is keep it physiologically, the first sense of keeping it in relationship with that which sustains it. So in Genesis 2:15, we might say Adam and Eve are put in the garden to serve and keep physiologically the garden. Moving on to fruitfulness, who are the first creatures given the commandment to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth? Anyone know? Yeah, it's the fish and the birds. And you know, the first time I asked, well, I don't even really realize that other beings were given that commandment besides humans.
The fish objected to the idea of filling the earth, by the way.
Yeah, you know, I hear there was a petition about that. Yeah, so birds wanted to stay in the sky and the fish in the sea, but otherwise they were happy about that. But it's interesting that if you look at extinction of species, the loss of biodiversity, and actual extinction of actual entire species, in a sense, caused by human, you know, human-caused extinctions now, is in a sense not allowing other species to fulfill their God-given mandate to be fruitful and multiply. So that's the fruitfulness principle, that all the that other creatures are also given this commandment, this from God. And Sabbath, of course, you know, we're given this, you know, keep the Sabbath, make it holy. But God, when the Israelites go into the Promised Land, God says to them, also, every 7 years, let the land be at rest. And if you don't do that, the language is quite strong, I will kick you off the land so that the land will have the rest that it needs and did not get while you were on it. So, and then, you know, I don't really like, this feels kind of like proof texting, you know, and you can prove almost anything if you want with one verse. So I'm also trying to get us to think through the biblical story as a whole, what is the sense we get of God's relationship with the land? That God asked other creatures, you know, to be fruitful and multiply, that God indicates a deep caring for the land so that it has the rest that it needs. In the Psalms, we read about all creation praising God, and how humans are a part of that, but not the only part. You know, the mountains are skipping for joy, the birds are singing, and they're all in their own way praising God. And then these are all, of course, Old Testament references. And one of the, if we move to the New Testament, I mentioned this briefly yesterday, but we might call it the sense of Christ as the cosmic Christ. And John 3:16, and then Colossians 1:15-20. You know, for God so loved the world, and that's, you know, usually translated world, which isn't bad. The actual word is cosmos. For God so loves the cosmos that God sends God's only Son, in John 3:16. And then even more powerfully in Colossians 1, where Christ is the one in whom all, through whom all things are created, in whom all things hold together, and in whom all things are reconciled. So this sense of God redeeming all of creation, and that all of creation is indeed part of that, part of God's concern in offering Christ for us and for the world, and indeed for the cosmos. And I also think of Acts. the cosmos singing of Acts, where Paul is preaching to the Athenians, and says, he's pointing to the statues around him, and there's this statue to the unknown God. Jeez. Okay. Must be a good meal.
Lentil loaf.
Oh yeah. They're glad dinner's over, or what? No, I like lentil loaf, really. So this, Paul says to Athenians, now I will preach to you about this unknown God. And it is this God in him, in whom we live and move and have our being. In whom we live and move and have our being. Again, a very imminent God, is it not, that Paul is referring to here. So does anyone else have something they want to throw out that you might point to in the scriptures or, yeah?
Just one other resource I was thinking of is the book Man and Mercy by Dan Erlander. It's in the bookstore here.
Okay.
But it very much talks about the brokenness of creation and bringing all of creation and creatures and humans and everything together. It's a wonderful book. It's
Manna and Mercy?
Manna and Mercy, yeah.
Thanks.
And it's in the bookstore here. You can browse through it.
And the Calvin DeWitt book, and he's from the more evangelical tradition. His book that I took these from is called Earthwise. And we have an annotated bibliography here, and some of these would be listed there too, not that one. But Larry, do you have anything else you want to throw out?
Well, I think just the comment that one reason why when we talk among ourselves or in groups and there's a kind of ask from what's there,
yeah,
and you don't get much in the way of response, it's because you can't find what you haven't been looking for. Now the biblical scholarship is starting to look
through these texts,
through the lenses, where you take that second creation account as a whole Yahwistic trajectory, and the whole Old Testament is one where human beings are identified with the soil. All the way through, it shows up again and again and again. But it wasn't, we didn't have the eyes to see it, the ears to hear. And we haven't done that with the New Testament yet. So, for example, biblical scholarship hasn't paid attention to place and the significance of place. Why is Jesus always going up mountains? What is this about mountains? What is this about the Sea of Galilee? Mm-hmm. You know, why this attention to particular places? What's associated with that? We haven't even asked that question. So you're not going to have people who are going to be able to answer the question about the significance of these elements if it doesn't jump right off the page. People's choices of which psalms to include in their devotions didn't include the creation psalms in any of them. No, they weren't looking for it. It wasn't a part of their view. You can't find what you're not looking for.
Yeah. And that's one of the things you're also suggesting we need to do in terms of the traditions and the scriptures,
right.
But the traditions, which is what you're doing a lot of.
It's changing presently, but it hasn't found its way into our common curriculum.
Yeah. Did you?
I was listening to Dan Karen this afternoon speaking from the Jewish tradition.
Yeah.
A stumbling block for me when I approach these things from a Christian perspective is you go back to Genesis 1 and fruitfulness or image of God, or you go back to Genesis 2 and you're going back pre-fall. And from a Christian perspective, we always have this sense that with the fall, everything got out of whack and we are no longer fully in the image of God, or the garden does not respond to our touch the way it used to, you know, thorns and thistles and that sort of thing. And it's always problematic for me as a Christian to go, but we've lost, you know, somehow we've lost the image, or the things are not the same harmony. Karen and Dan said, in the Jewish tradition, they said, you know, Jews don't have original sin, they don't have a fall.
Right.
It's our humanness, which I think we can translate, my word's not clear, but I think we can translate our unity with the earth, is not something we had and lost. It's the matter from Jews, we don't get to be human until we get some interesting little quirks in life. It's not until what we call the fall that you get to be human and it becomes interesting. I mean, how is it tough? So I like that. That was helpful for me.
You know,
that part of the intricacy of living in the environment and living in earth life are the complexities. I mean, it's not just, and have to be sin to say fish needs and my needs conflict. What do we do about that? It doesn't have to be the result of sin. I think what they might be saying, I'm really pushing them, but what they might be saying is from a Jewish perspective, this is where life gets interesting.
Yeah.
And this is where you call upon God in your spiritual depths and say, now, how do we move forward from here as simple, compassionate folks?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's not a sin-based problem.
Mm-hmm.
It is and then from a Jewish perspective, it's an obedience problem or a response problem or opportunity or whatever. But the fall is problematic for me in this sort of thing because we're trying to claim something which is some Christian theology, we say we've lost. So if we try to act out of the image or some of these things, I apologize for that.
But it's interesting, in the Noahic covenant, you know, it's after the fall and after the flood, and, you know, God makes a covenant with humanity, but also with all creatures, and doesn't give, there is this dominion verse in Genesis 1:26 that maybe we should talk about briefly, but there's no mention of that in the Noahic covenant, you know, this new covenant God makes with all the earth, with plants and creatures and humans as well. So that's just one difference in the two, in Genesis 1 and then Genesis 9, where Noah shows up. But first, maybe you want to say something?
Well, I was going to say another way of looking at the whole fall thing, a classic way of understanding it, is at least the first sin in that story is the sin of pride, assuming that if I eat of the fruit of the tree, then I will be like God. I will be the center of the universe. And that gets back to what we were talking about yesterday, this assumption that I am the heaviest, most important thing
in the known universe. Yeah.
And obviously I'm the most dense, but...
Seeing truth is the first step toward healing.
Yes. But to understand that part of the sin is that when we participate in the cultural religion of economism or consumerism or whatever we want to call it, we are participating again in that sin, that original sin that Christ came to save us from. And so Christ calls us to live back in, to live in a way that is pre-fall. I don't believe in original sin to begin with. Myself, but you know, if I'm dealing with someone who is, maybe that's a way to help them understand that.
Yeah, I guess where I was going with that is the worldview thing you first started with, you know, and when we deal with the scriptures, you know, what are the assumptions that we bring to them? Do we even know that we bring those assumptions?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyone else want to comment? What's your name?
Dave.
To Dave on that, or? And maybe we could talk about that some more afterwards. Yes.
Yeah. I always like to hear Jewish folks talk because their worldview is different. You know,
yeah.
Say scriptures that I think I understand. Yeah. You go, what?
That's, what do you think?
That's, yeah, that was really interesting. Thanks.
Yeah.
And now we're going to face this dominion verse, undoubtedly, if you're talking to folks about this stuff, in at least most churches. You know, in Genesis 1:26, we're put on the earth to have dominion over the earth, and so on. And it's a very strong word. There's two things I'd like to comment on it. One, in Hebrew culture, those who had dominion were kings. It was at this time, and apparently, in a couple readings I've done, a good king. You know, the Israelites had good kings and bad kings. Those who exercised their dominionship with mercy, justice, and compassion. Mercy, justice, and compassion were those who were thought of as good kings. So this sense of dominion being that we would operate that dominionship with mercy, justice, and compassion. And then looking at it Christologically, we call Christ King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And Christ says, and how did Christ exercise his kingship? I did not come to be served, but to serve and give my life for many. So both, and that kind of dovetails with this Genesis 2:15 of this being put in the garden to serve the garden. And so interpreted Christologically, we could say we exercise our kingship as followers of Christ, as those who serve that which we have dominion over. And those are at least two ways I've found helpful to me in thinking about the dominion verse, because that's a problematic one for many, and one that, for example, Lynn White pointed to in his article that I talked about yesterday. So let's cruise on to, and we can come back to that if there's time. And of course, then there's all kinds of sort of theological stuff like immanence, transcendence, or what is the fact that we believe in an incarnate God have to do with this stuff. So there's theological, deep theological traditions that we could explore, and that Larry's been exploring some this week, that would support why is this a Christian concern. So moving on to human and nature's economy, this sort of the global economic system. I was once asked to write an article for a Methodist publication on, so this is Manna and Mercy by Erlander, you'll get that. On the connections between consumption, overconsumption, poverty, and environmental degradation. Overconsumption, poverty, and environmental degradation. And it seemed to me like, well, isn't it obvious that they're very connected? And apparently it's not, because we need to be writing articles and talking about these things. And I thought, well, one of the reasons it seems to me it's not obvious, or maybe the reason, is that our economic system does not see itself as embodied or embedded within nature's economy. And therefore, we have all these externalities. And let's stop there and describe that a little. And so in the article, what would the nature's economy look like? You know, if we had there's a circle. This is nature's economy. And it seemed to me that the human economy would simply be a line. And over here in nature's economy, what are some characteristics of that economy? I mean, this is a circle. It also could be envisioned as our home, the earth. I put waste in quotes because there really isn't any waste. Everything's recycled. Waste becomes food. A tree falls in the forest, becomes a nurse tree for other trees, and so on. And it also, draws on local resources. Except, I guess you could say, the water cycle and air. Essentially, a ponderosa pine on this side of the Cascades in a really dry year can't scurry over to the west side with the Doug firs and get some water and come back. This economy creates and nurtures unique communities specific to place. And that's true of human communities as well, that are still sort of immediately and primarily dependent on a specific place. Moving over this way, the human economy, let's say we got capital, labor, resources, as we call what we get from the earth. And in the middle, we've got a lot of advertising and media. And out here, we have a lot of stuff, which this, you know, obviously some of our needs and wants are created. And that's, of course, some of the stuff we need, obviously, but a lot of we don't. And what have I left out here of sort of the diagram? And I sort of purposely left it out so far. Yeah.
One thing that intrigues me is the nature's economy knows times and seasons, and the human economy is 24/7.
Yeah. So there's this sort of rest, growth,
yeah,
cycle,
there's seasons, there's
life
day
and death.
And night, there's day and night.
Yeah.
You know, but that's pretty much on the human economy.
Yeah. So maybe cyclical and 24/7. Yeah. But what else have we left out here?
Consumers.
Waste
is what I was looking for, but we'll get to consumers in a minute. And it's interesting what economists call waste. Within our economic system, it's called externalities. So, I mean, the word itself indicates how we relate to those things, doesn't it? Waste here equals externalities. And it kind of blows me away that you can go through college or whatever and never hear about externalities, really. Or it seems to me that all disciplines should be talking about what does it mean to live in this world, within this economic system, and what's happening to the earth. But waste equals externalities here.
Mike, I think another factor in this side is also that perhaps the line should be a vector moving upward, that we always want growth.
Okay, yeah.
In terms of it's not just stuff, but it's always trying to have more stuff. And so we're trying to look at by what percentage should the economy grow each year.
Yeah. Larry?
Another factor that's left out is that you have to locate your line inside the circle.
Well,
I mean, the human economy is embedded in nature's economy. I mean, I know your point is that we're becoming ascetic about it. We think that it doesn't have a body. What's left out of your, on the right-hand side, is anything that has to do with nature's constraints. You know, the character of the atmosphere, for example.
Yeah.
The limits of how much pollution we want to dump into the sea.
But in some ways, I leave it out because it doesn't see itself as embedded.
Yeah.
At least our culture doesn't. I mean, we hope that the externalities can be assimilated, and we trust that the earth, in that sense, will assimilate everything and it will be embedded in that way. But obviously, that's not working. But you're right. I mean, this is obviously, and all this capital, labor, and resources is ultimately dependent on a healthy place for us all to live. And so on. So yeah, we obviously this happens somewhere. It happens on the earth, on our home. Let me just check out. Okay.
I have one question.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah.
What do you say about that? The last time I looked at, for instance, consumer data, stuff was still predominantly food and shelter.
Predominantly what?
Food and shelter.
Food and shelter?
What is that, a misapprehension on my part?
In response to that, I think that that's a part of stuff, but the question, especially for Americans, first world, is, you know, what kind of food shelter, especially what kind of shelter.
Yeah, and I have that in mind.
Well, and I'm not saying that, you know, we don't need a lot of the stuff that's put out or some of it, but the question is, both, you know, what kind is it and how is it produced? And therefore, what are the externalities that spin off from it? And I thought we could move the discussion briefly to, did you have a?
Oh.
No, okay. Let's see. Briefly to how we would move this system, because, I mean, it's overwhelming. I mean, it's all that we have is essentially brought to us by this system. And it doesn't recognize that there are limits, that we live in a sacred place, and so on. But how would we, how would we move the system, and how would our actions interact with those choices to move it toward closer to the circle? And so there our choices model a circle, essentially. And there's some really interesting work being done in this regard. For example, Michael's comment about how, you know, what's the slope of this line and how it always has to be going up. And, you know, if you read the newspapers and the gross domestic, or GNP, GDP is going up, things are good. Gross domestic product goes up 3%, 4%, 5%, whatever. That's good news. And that's unquestioned. It's sort of part of this implicit culture of religion. But it's not asked, well, how is GDP measured, for example? GDP is simply a measure of all goods and services that are produced in a year. So externalities can actually increase GDP if you install, pollution pays in some ways. Exxon Valdez oil spill increases GDP because you've got to get everyone up there and clean it, and you do the research on how to mitigate it in the future, and so on and so on. You install coal scrubbers, that increases GDP. And so on and so on. some folks in California are developing the GPI, Genuine Progress Indicator.
According to California standards.
The group is called Redefining Progress. Yeah. And it's very exciting work because they're subtracting Exxon Valdez oil spills, for example. They're saying, isn't our economic system supposed to be designed for our well-being? So wouldn't we subtract things that decrease the well-being of our life and the earth? So they subtract Exxon Valdez oil spills. They subtract costs of divorce, for example. If you have a divorce, you end up having more consumption because you need, lawyer's fees, for one thing, but also you have two apartments or two houses instead of one, you have more furniture, and so there are a lot of costs related to divorce. They try and look at social and ecological costs and subtract from that. So GDPI has gone down since the early 70s. GDP has, we're in a boom time, aren't we? I mean, it's been a great decade. But the GPI, it's in a sense, it's like, what are we looking for? And how are we measuring what we're looking for? So one thing you could do practically is support Redefining Progress, for example, or find a group that you feel is doing a good job of sort of beginning to shift the way our culture looks at these things. This is the biggest one in my mind. If we could get prices right. The market is actually a very efficient way of allocating resources and so on, and getting things to us and all that. I'm not suggesting the change is we move away from locally based market economies. But the information that flows through the market is based on how much things cost. So if the information, the price of an item is not accurate to what it really costs humans and the rest of the earth, then the information that we get when we buy something will not be accurate. So organic food now, at least if you buy it in a small food co-op, often will be more expensive. It's not always, we should point that out, and it's often actually, if you do a CSA, a community supported agriculture farm, it's cheaper or just the same as regularly produced produce. But what is it about the system of prices that's not giving us correct information? So if we would have, if we would internalize, see, it would basically means we internalize the externalities within the price that we pay or that our society pays for things. So a tomato produced in California with pesticides and fertilizers and big tractors and transported across the country and wrapped individually in cellophane, the price of that tomato would internalize the costs of soil contamination, of topsoil loss, of water degradation from pesticides in the water, of transportation costs, of global warming. What percentage would this tomato, transporting this tomato, be to global warming and so on? So it would be a way to internalize the cost of that tomato. And if you do that, you would still work within the system, but you would fundamentally change the information flowing through the system. And another very powerful way to do that is to change the way we tax ourselves. To move toward a more sustainable society, we would tax ourselves differently. And there's a book called Tax Shift by Alan Durning that looks at specifics of that. So, but the underlying message is one way we'd move toward sustainability and eventually reflecting living in a sacred universe is valuing all. And in some ways, it's still a rather profane exercise in that we're trying to place a value on what ultimately is priceless. But it is a very powerful way of working within the system we have now to move from here toward here. So, I believe you had a comment.
Nope, I don't think so.
You did. All right. Anyone else who hasn't said something yet want to say something before I go to Dave? Did you have something?
Yeah, it seems to me that if we could turn the economy around and have the industry and the economy based on improving the environment, whether it is in fact cleaning up the Exxon Valdez spill, but why can't, instead of this huge multi-billion dollar thing on, well, one example, the Beanie Baby culture thing, or the huge billion dollar industry of just creating playgrounds for the rich, you know, the ski resorts, the kind of stuff that most of us can't even touch but are so expensive, or the houses that are over $1 million. Why can't we turn our economy around and create the gross domestic product on cleaning up the environment, on feeding children, on getting people decent medical care who don't have it? And, you know, maybe that's simplistic, but it seems to me if there would be enough of us who looked at what do we value as humans in terms of social justice, in terms of environment, and somehow get the consumer and energy in those kinds of industries, that it would be a way of making it greener, a way of turning around. But I guess it's values that most people in our country just do not share anymore. It's what to do with all the people that have all this money to spend and they don't know what to spend it on instead.
Yeah, and
it's grabbing that market.
Sort of the power behind that,
yeah.
and creating the political will to shift in that way. And part of that would be, you know, if the people at GPI become, if more and more of us get behind that way of measuring the economy, for example, or a similar one, and they, as an organization, get more and more clout. But that requires more and more of us to be educated about that and put our weight behind them.
Right.
So that points to some of what we were talking about yesterday about how, what we can do. It's that political will portion of what we can do.
It would require a massive shift in our cultural orientation.
Yeah.
And most people would see that as, I suppose, in the values of the society is going backwards.
And
the response to what you just said, I think some of what we're talking about is happening, and I mean the truth is it's going to happen slowly. And I think there are two things that are happening. One is greenwashing, where companies or organizations are making profits off of the whole idea of being more environmentally sound. And so that's not quite where we want to go, but in some ways it's a step closer to at least realize. Yeah, and then the other one is
over messing it up more.
Sure, and the other one is sincere change, where I think companies realize that it is profitable to reuse some of their own waste products and reuse some of their resources. And I think one of the best examples I've seen of that is a carpet company that no longer thinks of it as we're going to sell carpet.
Do you remember the name of it?
I don't remember the name.
So I just wrote down carpet company.
Yeah. It's great, though. They're not saying we're going to sell carpet anymore. They're saying we're going to provide the opportunity for you to have our carpet. And so you rent it, and then instead of just selling you that object, they take care of it. So when it's no longer appeals to you and it degrades, you give it back to them. They kind of recycle their materials and give you back a new carpet. So you're not dealing with objects so much as a flow of services instead.
And there's other examples. Thanks, I was going to talk about that too. In Natural Capitalism, a book by Emery Lovins and Paul Hawken, called Natural Capitalism. And there are ways people are beginning, business are beginning to look at these, at modeling a circle more than the line.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and that's happening, you know, with some big companies now. It's starting to be something that I think will be perhaps one of the ways of the future. And people like Paul Hawken are trying to show businesses, hey, this can be profitable for you, and that's what we would have to show within the systems, that it would be profitable for them to do this as well. Larry?
I'm sure that getting the price right and taking their clues from the economy of nature, the way of organizing the human economy, would make a huge difference. It still might not get us away from what Cobb calls economism and measuring our social well-being by criteria. And I'm reading a very interesting book by Robert Lane called The Loss of Happiness in Market Democracies. And he has simply accumulated all the empirical evidence, the studies from here and there, going back from the 70s on forward, on the measures of subjective well-being, people's own testimony to their sense of fulfillment or happiness or well-being. And this has been declining. And so why is there a loss of happiness in market democracies that have been prospering? And the long and the short of it is that except for the poor, an increase of income and wealth, there's no correlation whatsoever to happiness.
Or a sense of well-being.
Or a sense of well-being. None whatsoever. At the same time, we keep saying it should and will.
Right.
And then when it doesn't,
it's like the substitute.
There's increased cases of depression, etc. So I think one thing that you know you're getting toward a sense of the sacred universe has to communicate is just on the basis of simple reporting that what people expect to find fulfilling bears no resemblance whatsoever to what they have, unless they're poor.
Yeah.
Then it does.
There's a baseline.
But once your basic needs of sufficient food and a shelter and a sense of social security, that you will be cared for, that you don't have to worry about where the next meal. After that, there's no resemblance whatsoever. There's no correlation whatsoever. So, I mean, getting that message out, which is an old religious message from time immemorial, it belongs to the wisdom traditions of all culture.
Thanks for saying that.
What is the message?
That there's no correlation of subjective well-being and well-being
and wealth.
And wealth and income. There's no correlation.
The level at which people report their well-being has stayed since 57. Our houses have doubled, our incomes have whatever, and yet it's declining. Or you know that was the high point in 57, actually. So we have a couple comments.
With this kind of discussion is that you've got to be assuming then that just about everybody you run into is either nuts or very low on some sort of intellectual level.
My
point about more stuff is that more stuff is tied to more people. For instance, what's the proper population of the globe from a Christian perspective? Will you stop at 6 billion? Will you stop at 10 billion? The driving forces behind this, the reason everybody has always wanted a growing economy, is because, quite frankly, every time the earth goes through an annual cycle, there's a whole lot more mouths to
Well, but see, market. Just, I mean, that's particularly in the West, it's a way that we can sort of shift blame, it seems to me. There's overpopulation with people, and there's overpopulation with consumption. Mm-hmm. Our impact on the earth is a factor of, is a number of people and the amount those people consume. And you can look at any category, energy use, food, et cetera, transportation. The United States is way out of whack in its use of resources.
I grant you
and
that.
So,
but one of the reasons we're running as fast as we are is that the rest of the world is starting to catch up on that, and they're catching up in that element called labor.
That's the way the system, that's what the system requires. That's the way you do it.
But people who are willing to work for a whole lot less are beginning to intrude upon our lifestyle. And why not? Why wouldn't they deserve an opportunity to do as well as we do?
Yeah, but Larry's point is that our sense of well-being does not increase with increased wealth. And that is what we keep holding out there. Well, if we just had a little bit more, we would then be happy. And that's what we also hold out to the rest of the world, because we are marketing that same perspective around the world. And the fact is that
that's the energy that's driving the problems you're talking about. See, that's the thing. Just because we don't understand most things.
There's a psychology of consumption, and we compare ourselves to our peers, and we feel less sort of well off if the people around us are sort of increasing. And what we see in the media is all these rich and famous people and their levels of consumption and so on. It feeds sort of a sense that I don't have enough. And so I think it gets back to a real, but we all do buy into it.
As a society, we do buy into it.
Well, it's fine. I'm not responsible for it.
Well, go back there.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
You too.
The advertising puts a different care in front of us. And so we have a bigger home, we need the jet ski and so on. And we have that, and then we say we've got it all, and they put the different carrot out there. And that's just what you're saying, too. Larry, too.
Isn't it?
In terms of the stuff, if you think only of food and shelter, we've left out a major range of human need. And Freud said a basic human need is pleasure. Adler said a basic human need is power. And Viktor Frankl said a basic human need is meaning and having a sense of purpose. If we look for what we really spend money on, it is the attempts to have pleasure and power, and often thinking that's going to give us meaning. I think what's happening in our society is the meaninglessness of our existence, that we did all this and yet feel meaningless.
Yeah. So again, it's a false idol in a sense. It's something we pursue that does not fulfill that which it promises. There, and then Larry, and then Bob.
I can't help but agree with everything you're saying. But it seems to me that this is pretty small peanuts response to the appropriate use of our global resources. Overpopulation has created deforestation, desertification. Those things carry a much larger percentage of the problem than our consumption.
Well, I think that's very debatable. It depends what causes. Larry, do you want to say something first? And you said.
The population curve correlates with one thing only, industrialization. If you want to look at where the scale of human numbers took off, it comes with an industrial society. And as more and more countries, people, societies get in on that, people will live longer. You'll add a generation. I mean, the highest growth rates in the world are Europeans in the century from about 1820 to 1930, when industrialization took off. And then the extension of that around the world increases the population there as well. The highest rates of immigration in the world are still Europeans out of the industrial revolution that got this kind of economy going. So we're still talking about, and it's exploded since 1950.
Yeah,
because it's gone global. So it's the way the system, and this is the bind that we're in. This is the system that produces the population that then requires the stuff in order to address it on those terms. But it's also, we have other possibilities of ways of doing it more in keeping with nature's economy. But it still promotes what you were saying earlier, this kind of economistic. I mean, it's a very what is reality and what is understood to be real? One of a really unsettling study is the one which says that teenagers now can identify the logos of 100 corporations and can't name 10 native plants where they live. Yeah. Okay, what's real there for them? It's the world of artifacts. There's no connection with the world on which they literally depend for the air they breathe. It's a disconnect.
The happiest people we work with around the world, the people in countries in which television had not yet taken over, because their expectations were life, the life they were living, and not what they needed as they were told through the screen.
Troy, did you want to say something?
Incidentally, population then goes down
after the
while, because we fear we can't, that our children, we need to provide this kind of high level of living. We can't do that if you have all that many kids. So everywhere in the world now, population rates are declining.
Even in the...
The numbers are still going up because you're starting with
such
a
large base. Yeah.
But the population rate is declining.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I think we need to close.
If we talk sustainability at this point, from the things that I've read, we still are not, the population is still at a sustainable level if we do not want to sustain the lifestyle and the type of lifestyle that we do here in the United States. And we examine the way we eat and the way we farm and the way we sustain our lives. But the problem is we don't perceive that to be an acceptable level. And I think beyond just television as being a destructive force in the values and the way we view the way we think we should live, I think that the corporations that themselves, the expectations that they put on people of ridiculous work hours, or having to move your family all the time if you want to go up, is that again going up?
Yeah.
We want to go up. We want to move up in the corporation. We want to move up in the society. We want to move up. Corporations do not help. I mean, they feed themselves by giving us this false sense of what we need to do to be happy and to be successful. Also, they're as guilty as television in that they expect their employees to embrace these values and to embrace these ways of working and ways of living. And so I think that we need to spread some of that blame beyond just our media to, and maybe the media has created this view in the corporation, but I think it may be the other way around.
Well, the media doesn't do it. It comes from companies.
Yeah, and I think that... I'm not sure what I think as far as, is it going to be easier because we have fewer and fewer corporations owning more and more to change things, or is it going to be harder because it's a bigger object to try and get moving in a different direction? You know, it's something to analyze.
Dave, you've maybe wanted to say something for a little while here. I don't know if you've had a chance.
Yeah, well, the thing I was starting with is you take your cyclical system, and what I'm hearing people say is, we aren't part of the system that we want to be part of. We don't behave like any other organism in natural balance.
Mm-hmm.
Aspen trees will take over the environment if you let them, but they don't because there's checks and balance built in. And somehow humans have found a way to override or ignore the checks and balance. So what you said about information flow, I think, is very interesting. You know, how is it we've managed to change the information flow so that we can function differently in the system. So what I'm struggling with is the fact that we are the only part of the natural cycle system that's making choices, not based on information, but based on something else. You know, our worldviews or whatever you have to say. So I don't see any way we can step ourselves back into the system. I'm thinking now of Ted Peters, who was here last year, who was talking about ethics of choice in terms of genetic information. He says, we've got genetic information. He says, we will have designer children in the future. because it will not work to say, you can't do that. He says, we're going to do it. So how do you get people to say, how do we choose, how do we make responsible choices in the world of choice? Because that's the only thing that we can work with. And I'm wondering about the same thing about these issues of human economy. You know, we are choice makers, unlike, in a way that's different than trees or fish or water.
Yeah.
And that's around the
world at one point of that. The people who are dying of AIDS in Africa and the people who are starving, wherever they're starving, have slipped back into the system, believe you me.
Yes. But those of us who abuse the system have co-opted information. And in an information age, I think that's a huge issue.
You know what, gang? It's 6:15. So thank you all for your time. And